Hello, everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. This is the Malloy Program. I'm not video streaming tonight, so don't freak out. We'll be back again tomorrow. We're having a headphone amplifier situation here, which will be fixed by tomorrow night. Have you noticed the latest madness from the right wing in this country? The word is out there. There are certain members, I guess they're teabaggers, running for various congressional offices who are beginning to say, or have been saying for a while now, these are the real crazy people, but they're saying that Obama is more dangerous to the United States than Al-Qaeda or terrorism or mass killers. They're also saying that liberals are responsible for all this bad stuff that's going on, even though it's been corporatists who have been in charge of this country since 1980, for sure, and possibly longer than that. Remember, the last liberal to occupy the Oval Office was Richard Nixon. Seriously, I'm not trying to be cute with you. Yeah, he was a Republican. Yeah, he was a megalomaniac, but he was also a liberal. And you know that by the policies that were enacted during his presidency. But I digress. So since, and Carter certainly wasn't a liberal. Oh my God. So starting with Reagan and Bush 1, and Clinton and Bush 2, and now Obama. There hasn't been a liberal in the White House, you could make the argument, maybe, other than Dick Nixon, since who? Harry Truman? And I don't even think Truman was a real liberal. So where do you have to go? Back to FDR? Back to the 30s and 40s in this country? But these rat bastard right-wingers are out there all over. You ought to see the political ads here in Georgia. For local state house offices, local, and I'm sure this is true in your state, for the Georgia General Assembly, either the House or the Senate, they're using the commie treatment on their opponents, the same way it was used in the 50s. And this is among Republicans, because Democrats running for public office here in Georgia within the state don't have an ice cube's chance in hell. The state has gone totally into hell. It's run by Republicans. It's being bankrupted by Republicans. The school boards are failing. Public health is failing. Everything is just going down the tubes in Georgia. Of course, we've had a Republican administration now for 8 years and a Republican House and Senate. But I digress again. The commercials being run, the political ads being run by these bone-chomping, ankle-nibbling freaks. I've never seen such a collection of crazy white people. I mean, it's just, and the women are just as bad as the men, if not worse. But you look at these political commercials for local state representative, local state senator, and the opponent of these people, whether it's another Republican in a runoff, or, God forbid, there's a Democrat somebody or somewhere that is going to run against these monsters. But they're all being accused of being liberals. Obama, Pelosi, Reid, liberals! Destroying America! A threat! And you know the latest? Liberals are trying to deny Americans the right to commune with their precious, precious Savior, Jesus H. Christ. That's the latest. The liberals are trying to destroy Christianity. The liberals have destroyed the economy. The liberals are undermining the military. The liberals have given all this money to Wall Street. The liberals this. And unions, they talk about unions. Are you going to align yourself with unions and Barack Obama? Or are you going to vote for God and America and me here in Georgia? What are you going to do? Unions? Unions? 8% of the American workforce is unionized? It's madness. Now, there's only one conclusion that you can draw from this. And that is very simply, the people running for public office as a Republicans are insane. They're completely insane. They have Obama derangement syndrome. They're nuts. I wouldn't give you 10 cents for every single Republican office holder in the state of Georgia on a state and national level. They're ignorant idiots, every single one of them, every single Republican. There's not a person of color among them. They all try to out-Jesus each other and out-conservative each other. It's amazing and sickening and disgusting. And I bet it's true in your state, too. So now Barack Obama is more of a danger to the United States, the security of the United States, than Al-Qaeda and the Nazis and the Soviets and Fidel Castro. Did you see Castro on television today? I mean, my God, the skinny, ancient old man who has managed to outplay, outlast, outmaneuver, and outsurvive how many presidents of the United States? And how many signals? Oh, and by the way, the governor of Georgia, Sonny Perdue, has recently been all over Cuba trying to cut deals for Georgia peanuts and Georgia tobacco and Georgia soybeans and Georgia cows and Georgia this and Georgia that. But there's Fidel Castro, another one of these liberal commie icons that the right wing wants you to be terrified of. Oh, my God, look at him. Look at him. Yeah, look at him. Take a look at a picture of Fidel Castro. He looks like he just stepped out of a tuberculosis hospital. Well, my God, what is he, 90? I don't know, 80? Don't send me an email. I really don't care what the man's age is. I remember when he got power. Christ, I was in high school. I remember. But the Republicans in this country have finally, I mean, they've just pitched over. They're nuts. Every single one of them is insane. Completely insane. Everything that they say is gibberish and nonsense. That's why I say, elect these bastards. Vote them in. Yes! Yes! Vote Republican! I don't care what your party affiliation is. It doesn't matter anymore. Vote Republican. Give it to them. Give it all to them. And then, of course, it collapses, and the fires start, and the tumbrils start to roll across the town squares, and eventually we cleanse ourselves of the sickness, this right-wing sickness. It's a disease. I used to think that conservatism was some kind of a political cult. It's not. It's a disease. It's a mental slash spiritual slash physical illness. And the only way to purge the body, we have to go back to the Middle Ages. It's time for a bleeding. It's time to bring out the leeches. You know what I'm saying? It's time to open up a couple of veins. Let the poisonous ethers out. Now let the humors fly into the ozone. We've got to purge ourselves of the whole concept of republicanism or conservatism. So let's do it. Vote them in. Vote them into office. Vote them in. Give it to them. Seriously. Give it to them. Let them have the country. Will there be destruction and death and sickness and collapse and chaos? Yes! And out of that will come resurrection. Cowboy, lead the travesties. Flying just to justify. Mama, who you please. A cowboy can be fatal. Can make you paranoid. Just a person to avoid. You rave against the terrorists, then murder like they do. You even claim the peaceniks, terrorizing them. Your old friends and allies, you see as enemies. It's mighty freaking dangerous, red cowboy disease. Red cowboy disease, red cowboy disease. You won't find them funny when they go on killing spirits. Red cowboy disease, red cowboy disease. Please put them all in packs.
Your Day Screaming with Mike Malloy.
Yeah, it's the end of that song by R.E.M. as we know it, too. Well, you got to get that one out of here. It's the end of the world. 21 past the hour. We have a couple things to cover tonight. The police involved in the post-Katrina shootings and cover-up have been charged. Hopefully, they'll be charged with murder. We'll get to that a little bit later tonight. This was a story that a reporter, a writer, I should say, for The Nation, tried to get in front of the public and apparently succeeded years ago. And I think Mother Jones spent some time on it, too. Now it's finally become something that the mainstream media is paying attention to, and indictments have been handed down or handed up or whatever it is. We'll get to that later tonight. Good news for me and my affiliates. A federal appeals court today ended the FCC's indecency policy, saying that the FCC's guidelines for fleeting expletives and other indecencies in broadcast were vague and violated the First Amendment. You're right. I completely agree. The opinion, even though it was a win for Fox Television, CBS Broadcasting, and ABC, all of whom had petitioned the U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals, saying guidelines on fleeting expletives. I love that term. That's like an expletive that runs into the room and says, "Kiss my ass!" and runs out. Only much worse than that. That's a fleeting expletive. Anyway, that the guidelines on the use of fleeting expletives were arbitrary and capricious, not to mention ridiculous. I mean, my God, somebody tell me, what's the difference when you watch HBO and the F word is all over the place, not to mention simulated sexual intercourse between actual naked people of same sex and opposite sex? What's the difference between that and a radio talk show host saying the F word? There is none. I mean, it's ridiculous. This is crazy. But this has to do with the Puritan ethic, you know, the Republican, the early Republicans, the Puritans, the ones that came over here with pursed lips. Well, we're not going to have anything like that here. Mm-mm. We're not even going to celebrate Christmas. It's just a little bit too raucous. You know, that character from SNL, the church lady. I mean, it was just so such a real-life character, right? But anyway, the three-judge panel of U.S. Second Circuit in New York said the FCC's policy was, quote, unconstitutionally vague, creating a chilling effect that goes far beyond the fleeting expletives at issue here, end quote. Now, the FCC's approach to fleeting F-bombs and the like can be credited to Bono, U2 frontman, who at the Golden Globes Award in 2003 said upon winning his award, "This is really, really brilliant, really, really great." Now, I can say the word, right? Here in the East, it's after 9 o'clock. I think I'm going to challenge. Yeah, because if I say the F-word, and some of our affiliates drop my program, could I sue them? Huh? Now, the other thing, you know, a over-the-air broadcast station and Sirius or XM, they're all over the air. I mean, Sirius and XM doesn't come to you through the water, right? But you know what the difference is? You have to subscribe to HBO or Sirius or XM. Whereas ABC, you don't have to subscribe unless you get it on cable, in which case you have to subscribe anyway. So what's the difference? And as far as talk radio is concerned, is it worse to hear me drop an F-bomb or to hear Glenn Beck just talking about, well, Barack Obama is the worst threat to America and to Jesus since, God, I don't know, since, Pontius Pilate? Somebody tell me the difference. After complaints about Bono's comments, the FCC declared that a single non-literal use of an expletive. Non-literal. Yeah, he didn't say, go F yourself. That would be literal, I guess, although it's impossible. But he used it as an adjective, not a verb. I guess that's a difference, right? Anyway, after the FCC declared that a single non-literal use of an expletive could be, quote, actionably indecent. Whoa. Now, at the time, indecency in broadcast was a very hot issue with the FCC because television viewers were all upset over Janet Jackson's nipple exposure. Remember that at the 2004 Super Bowl? And so Congress, at the time, under the control of Republicans, raised the maximum penalties for broadcast indecencies from $32,000 to $325,000. That's why I've been warned so many times by the affiliates. And I appreciate, sort of half kidding, I appreciate their patience with me because I do lose it. And now that we web stream, you know, and I think the, when the broadcast part, I think, okay, we're in commercials, but if the microphone's still open and I say things, ooh. But I think I'll stick with the radio station guidelines. Either that or I can go back to selling magazine subscriptions on the phone.
Seekers, here's the truth speaker, Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Prairie 2's rant tonight. I've got to share this with you. It's one of you know, I like what he writes about. I really do. Sometimes it gets a little oblique for me to try to figure out what the hell he's trying to say. Except it's scary stuff. But I know there are people listen to this program who get what he's saying with very little effort. I usually do it just every once in a while when he gets into, you know, foreign currencies or some, you know, just some of the more, to me, esoteric aspects of the global economy and how it's rapidly dying and deteriorating. I get lost. But not with this one this evening. I want you to hear this, all right? It is titled, The Efficiency of Privatization or How to Cook Lamb. Now, this ties in with, you know, the beginning of the program. So, Prairie 2 writes, the trade deficit jumped up more than expected in May, increasing by a full 5%. And this signals a lack of real recovery in the U.S. economy. The trade deficit should have eased with the drop in the price of oil, and the opposite trend dovetails with the lack of job creation in this country to indicate that the economy is headed for the double dip at full speed. Corporations, you see, are flush with cash, having a cool trillion laying around with nothing to spend it on, but they have little incentive to invest. Why? Well, the right wing will tell you. Obama is keeping jobs from being created because he's anti-business. While it's true that the multinational companies can pump unlimited pollution into the air and water in third world countries and pay slave wages, you know, in the libertarian paradises, these countries don't have much market for goods either. So the goods come to the United States and create a trade deficit. Europe's standards for pollution are much stricter than in the United States, and the pay and benefits for workers are much better, and yet their manufacturing hasn't disappeared. So contrary to the propaganda coming from the right, neither the Obama administration nor the United States in general is hostile to business, nor is it true that they're being taxed to death. Remember, they aren't short of cash, these corporations, and CEO pay isn't suffering either. You see, the right likes to claim there is a high corporate tax rate in the United States. Ooh! But of the 40 industrialized countries, the United States collects the least corporate taxes. And in fact, two-thirds of corporations operating in the United States pay zero taxes. Two-thirds of the corporations operating in the United States pay nothing. The corporation's share of federal tax collections have gone from 45th in the 1950s to down around 6% today. Many corporations also gain windfalls from various levels of government for creating jobs. Government doesn't create jobs, you know. Or they get money for things like oil depletion, where we wind up paying them for them having used up our resources. Eh? And that makes corporations negative taxpayers. But don't call this welfare. Welfare is what poor people get. That would be the people who work for these corporations but still need Medicaid and all sorts of other government aid and are putting strain on the food banks. Homeless shelters are seeing wintertime numbers in July this year, and more than half of the homeless are families. Many of them are working but cannot make ends meet. Plus, you have 40 people per minute, yes, per minute, that are running out of unemployment benefits and could be looking for a cot in an already full shelter in the very near future. The corporate wage slaves, lucky enough to still have a job, pay plenty of taxes, though. With Reagan having doubled the payroll tax and all federal excise taxes, many of which are not disclosed, but are concealed by law when you buy something. For example, Truth Seeker, I digress a bit from Prairie 2. Have you looked at your phone bill lately and notice, are the excise taxes still there on the phone bill? Are they still there when you buy a set of tires? Now, I honestly don't know. But you know where the excise tax came from? I believe, and I'm sure Prairie 2 or Michael or Irish Dave will correct me here, but I believe excise taxes on tires came, what, during World War II? Sales taxes have doubled or even tripled since Reagan began his war on America. So have user fees and fines as cities seek to balance their budgets with red light cameras and reduced public services. Then you have the looting of the commons by all manner of public work. Let me back up. Then you have the looting of the commons as all manner of public works are being sold off for pennies on the dollar to balance local budgets. You can't tax the rich or they'll leave and take all the jobs with them. Formerly, public property is then leased back at ever-increasing rates, so the public pays to use the government infrastructure they've already paid for. And they keep paying for it over and over again. For example, the geniuses in charge of Arizona have sold the state office buildings, including the Capitol building, and then rent them from a transnational corporation. And this sort of nonsense is going on everywhere. Conservatives call this the efficiency of privatization because it makes money efficiently for the rich. The wealth of the middle class is evaporating too, and their children will not be better off than their parents were for the first time in American history. This is not a natural occurrence or even the failure of the capitalist system. It is the result of the capture of the entire economic and political system by a relative handful of very rich people. The average American has fallen for the lie that capitalism is a natural system that doesn't need rules, or that the very rich should run things because they have our interests at heart. Americans are a flock of sheep who have turned their pasture over to a pack of wolves in pinstripe suits sporting flag pins. Prairie2.com. It's just amazing. The madness of the political season is starting to flutter all around this country now, like the wings of a death angel. And what are the Republicans saying? I don't care if it's Arizona or Georgia or some upstate precinct in New York or, some sparsely populated congressional district in South Dakota. Doesn't make any difference where it is. What are the Republicans, what are they pitching this year? Huh? What are they pitching? Fear. Again, fear. Fear of Obama, that he's a communist or a socialist or, you know, here is Obama who is cutting as many deals as he thinks is necessary with corporate America, and they still don't like him. They still don't like him. What did I read? The big bucks on Wall Street. You know, the bastards that were bailed out by a Republican fake president and a Democratic real president, these predatory bastards on Wall Street are contributing like 75% of their filthy money now to Republican candidates. And here Barack Obama and the Democrats have bent over backwards, have pretzelized themselves in order to satisfy these sick capitalist predators. This is madness. This is absolute insanity. Obama administration hostile to business. Oh, my God. Corporations are being taxed to death. Oh, my God. But we average Americans are so lost in the dark. I mean, we're wandering around at midnight in a coal mine shaft 7,000 feet below sea level. You know what I'm saying? And there's no lights and there's no oxygen. And we're just bumping into stuff until finally there's a methane explosion and we all die. We're blind, deaf, and stupid. I wish it weren't that way, you know? Don't you? Don't you wish it weren't that way? We'll be right back.
Right inside the night, I'm waiting for the light. Seems like I'm in the middle. Looking for something that I can't touch and sometimes can't even believe in. Oh, oh. Cradled by the hands of faith, the faith that sometimes wraps around too tight. So tight. Saved in the lights and baby.
More Flying Monkey Free Fun and Frivolity with Mike Malone.
10 before the hour, and lest this story drop completely off the radar screen, which American media wish it would, the Israeli military, after conducting an intensive investigation, has found that the killings aboard the Mercy Flotilla to the people in the prison camp known as Gaza, those killings were justified. An Israeli military investigation found that the killing of 9 Turks on board was justified, according to an official summary of the findings released Monday. This is according to the New York Times. Retired Major General who led the inquiry presented his classified findings to the military chief of staff. They were not released to the public, but a statement issued by the military, the Israeli military, said that at least 65 Turkish Islamic militants armed with metal sticks and knives were on the flotilla's main ship and had vowed to fight any effort by the Israeli Navy to board. If you were on a ship and it was flagged by the United States and the Israeli military tried to board and you were in international waters and you were on a mercy mission, what would you do? Oh, wait a minute. Something like that already happened, didn't it? Yeah, back in 1967. The scuffle that ensued, I love that word, scuffle. The scuffle that ensued after these fully armed terrorists landed on board the ship, the scuffle that ensued led to Israeli commandos shooting the nine Turks. The investigators praised the commandos, who rappelled onto the main ship from helicopters, saying that they, quote, operated properly with professionalism, bravery, and resourcefulness, end quote. They called the use of live fire justified. A second investigation, led by retired Supreme Court justice and including two foreign observers, has just begun its work. Neither investigation, however, according to the New York Times, it seems likely to satisfy demands for a full international investigation by the Turkish government. Turkey has withdrawn its ambassador from Tel Aviv and threatened further steps unless Israel issues an apology and sets up an international inquiry. Look, that's already happened. It was called the Goldstone Report, and we know what happened to that. The report finds that there was at least one gun on board. Because an Israeli soldier took a bullet in the knee that was not from an Israeli weapon. The report also contends that Israeli soldiers most likely fired only after having been fired upon first. However, passengers aboard the flotilla have mostly told a very different story, with some witnesses accusing the commandos of shooting randomly as they came aboard. Well, you know, you and I, Truth Seeker, probably, I don't know about you, but I have never been in the military, but I've seen enough movies. When an act of piracy is committed by Somalis or Israelis, or by the United States, they don't come rappelling down with their guns in an unlocked, unloaded position, do they? Can you imagine IDF forces or U.S. Navy SEALs or Somali pirates or whoever illegally boarding a ship in international waters? In other words, committing an act of piracy and just coming on board saying, hello, hey, listen, everybody, time to stop. Oh, that's far enough. You can't go any further. Everybody, listen up. Time to stop. And as they come rappelling down from the helicopters, that's what they're saying. Hello! Down on the deck! Here we come! Woohoo! That's not the way it happens in the movies, is it? And it's also not the way it happens in real life. But the Israeli government, investigating the policies of the Israeli government, has decided that everything that was done that resulted in the deaths of nine Turks and I think two, was it 11 people that died? I don't know. I guess it doesn't matter. Because the people who died are not American and they're not Israeli, so it doesn't matter. But that all that death, all that destruction, was completely justified, even though the ships being towed into harbor and unloaded, and what was found? Weapons? Missiles? Guns? Bullets? Actually, no. None of that. But the killings were justified. The killings are justified because those bastards in Gaza had the absolute temerity to hold free elections at the insistence of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, and they held the free elections, and Hamas won. Oh, no! Oh, no, 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 no! That would be like holding free elections in Israel and Likud wins and the United States decides to surround Israel and embargo the entire country. Well, we don't like Likud, so we're going to blockade your country. But you can't do that. Ah, but we're going to. Why? Because we don't like the outcome of your election. Because you killed 36 American sailors in 1967 who were on board the USS Liberty and they were doing nothing. That's murder! Cut, stop. Okay, stop the film. Cut. Listen, boys, we're having a little trouble with the dialogue here. This is not in the script. Who's this guy on the radio? What is this? What's he talking about? USS Liberty. Oh, my God, 67. Please. And why all the nasty comments here about our report? I mean, it was an honest, fair report. It was all about what happened that night when the Israeli commandos had to jump on board because, well, let me go back to the beginning. We came over in helicopters, you see, and we came down these roads and all the way. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy Show. And once again, we are not streaming video tonight. BP, as you know by now, of course, is testing. They're getting ready to testing a new tighter fitting cap that has been placed on this geyser of death in the Gulf of Mexico. I've been watching some of the video of this eruption from hell or the opening of one of Earth's arteries, depending on which point of view you want to take. What they're trying to do, and of course you know this from watching this garbage on television today, but they've got the cap on and they're allowing the oil to continue to flow out the top of it. And now they're going to begin step two, which is to close some of the vents and see if the pressure is great enough to indicate that there is not a break someplace below the surface of the bottom of the ocean, where this knife has been stabbed into the breast of the Gulf of Mexico. If the pressure is high enough to indicate that there is not a secondary or tertiary flow, I did it. I worked in the word tertiary into a regular sentence. I'll be damned. If these additional flows don't exist, then I guess that means it's a success, and they can begin then to, once the second drilling monster is completed, to inject mud and concrete and do a bottom kill. Since the top kill didn't work, it's going to be a bottom kill, all of which sounds vaguely obscene. The whole enterprise is more than vaguely obscene, but everything they've talked about either sounds like part of a Fred Astaire movie or sounds like people doing weird sexual things Would you like to do a bottom kill?
Well, I don't know. What does that mean?
So we should know, I guess. I guess we should know, if you want to believe BP, which I don't particularly, I guess we should know whether or not this latest move was successful by sometime tomorrow. If it is not successful, and this is interesting. I was watching Keith Olbermann's program earlier tonight, and he had this expert on that he's had a couple of times. And the question is raised, they're not that far away with the secondary drilling pipe or whatever, the drilling thingy. They're not that far away. And so why not from the volcano eruption? So why not wait another couple of weeks? I mean, the answer is obvious because this thing is gushing more death and destruction into the Gulf. But if this is a do or die moment, why not wait until the secondary well has penetrated the first well and they can begin the injection of mud and concrete and then start tightening up all the valves and holes on the new cap? Because then, according to this expert, if there is a break someplace else, it's not under the sea floor, it's not going to, in the pipe, it's not going to result in another oil explosion to blow off completely what they've just done, or something like that. So, today was apparently the big day in a series of big days. Where are we now? Are we at 3 months yet? It's hard for me to even think about this, much less watch the video. Every time I look at the live stream of the stuff gushing up into the Gulf, and I'm way up here in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains, but I look at this and it's giving me PTSD. How could it not give anyone monumental, massive trauma and the stress that results from it? How can you look at that? I guess Republicans can look at that and say, well, you know, stuff happens. Besides, we shouldn't be doing less drilling. We should be doing more drilling. Freedom isn't free, you know. But normal people look at this on television, and how can you not look at this and just be completely traumatized and the stress that comes with it? And I'll tell you, this is going to last, Truth Seeker. I don't care how old you are. This is going to last the rest of your life. Do you understand that? The images are going to stick in your head until you die. They're going to be there forever. Not that you'll be thinking about this when you're sucking in your last breath, but I'm just saying the images are going to be call upable in your memory banks for the rest of your life. That's A. Here's B. The disaster, the destruction, the death that this has caused is going to be around in the Gulf of Mexico until your great-grandchildren are sucking in their last breath. How's that grab you? And what will happen to British Petroleum and the rest of the oil industry in the meantime? Oh, well, you know, stuff happens. Did everybody get their balls in an uproar? I mean, my goodness, stuff happens. You know, freedom isn't free. It's Obama's fault, you know. He put all those environmental laws into place, and it drove the drillers further and further and further offshore. Why did they go deeper and deeper? What do you expect? It's Obama. You know, he was born in Kenya. Jesus God. The YMCA, this 166-year-old organization that I spent a lot of time at when I was a kid. I loved the Y. I liked the camp I went to, the, what do they call it these days, sleepover camp. That was the only kind that was around in the 50s. But the YMCA, which was like a second, oh, hell, it was like a first home to me. You know, when you live in an attic with three siblings and your mom and dad, you know, the YMCA is like, oh, my God, this is the Taj Mahal. But the Y to me was just wonderful. I was never molested there. Nobody ever got fresh with me. And this is back in the day. This would be a shock, not to men of a certain age, but back in the day, we all swam nude at the YMCA. Everybody swam naked. Now, of course, it was single gender. I mean, it was the YMCA. The YWCA was across the street. And I used to think, oh, my God, do the girls swim naked too? Ah! And I couldn't stand that thought. But all of us little boys, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, well, I think, when did I join? I think I was 8. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, 13 years old. Now, when you got to be a teenager, you had the option of wearing a bathing suit if you wanted to. But everybody went naked. And that's all I remember, is everybody went naked. And the YMCA camp in southern Michigan was just wonderful. I went there for like 7 years as a camper and then went as a worker and worked in the horse barns. To this day, when I smell neat's foot oil or get around a stable or smell a horse manure, it just flashes me back to those days. Washing horses down at night with salt water and putting blue ointment on their saddle sores because they were hauling little city boys around all day long on their backs. Catching them in the morning with a metal bucket with oats in the bottom, and you'd shake the bucket. And they would come. You put a rope halter on them and take them back to the corral and saddle them up, get ready for another day. I loved working in the horse barn and then becoming a Western riding instructor. We didn't do English. We did Western. But I digress. Oh, my God, there's a commercial. All right, the YMCA has changed its name. Well, it's downsized. They've taken out the men and the Christian and the association. Now it's just called the Y. Uh-oh, wait till the Christian fundamentalists hear about this.
Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
Twenty-one past the hour. So the YMCA is remaking its image and shrinking its name down to one solitary letter, the Y. Now, that's the letter in YMCA that stands for young. The Y will also sport a logo with a brighter color combination in a more contemporary font. It was due for a makeover. Its former logo, the sixth since its inception, had been in place since 1967. The organization, according to what I have here, spent 2 years doing market research and analysis to come up with a new logo. The Y's senior vice president and chief marketing officer, whose name is Kate Coleman, said, quote, it's a way of being warmer, more genuine, more welcoming when you call yourself what everyone else calls you. Oh, okay. Yeah, we never called it, hey, I'm going down to the YMCA, want to come along? Well, I said, hey, I'm going the Y. You get to swim naked. The president and CEO of the Y said in a company press release yesterday that the rebranding comes at a time when it has become increasingly important to build awareness for the work the Y does. According to the Y's research, more than half of Americans believe their quality of life is worse than it was a year ago. Wonder why the number's so low, more than half. Wouldn't you say more than 80, 90%? Oh, well. You know, this is not new, YMCA to Y, American Association of Retired Persons to AARP, National Public Radio to NPR, and British Petroleum to BP. The Y, I'll be damned. Okay. Oh, and Tom wants to remind me here about the flotilla. An American was killed on the aid flotilla. It's a 19-year-old American citizen with the group. His name was Furkan Dokan, I believe. He was a Turkish-American. And according to what Tom says, he was assassinated with four bullets to the head and one to the abdomen. 19 years old. Apparently, on this administration's watch, Barack Obama's watch, it is perfectly acceptable for American humanitarian aid workers to get assassinated on the high seas as long as those assassins are Israeli. An American citizen shot dead, 19 years old. Of course, we have American citizens who are 19 being shot dead every day. But this guy was not in a combat zone. He was in international waters in the open sea. Oh, well. I'm sure the Israelis can justify the killing of a 19-year-old with four bullets to the abdomen and one to the head. He might have been the one with the pistol. Oh, and then there's this. Excuse me. A Yemeni man. That would be a man from Yemen who was held at Guantanamo for 8 years, has been sent home. The guy is now 26. When he was detained, he was 18. A U.S. court ordered his release, saying he had no connection to Al-Qaeda and had been wrongly detained. But wait a minute! No, that can't be! Because Dick Cheney told us that only the dead-enders, or was that, who was the Secretary of Defense? Rumsfeld, that was his term, dead-enders. It was Cheney that said only the worst of the worst, the most dangerous of the dangerous, were being held. Well, here's one who was 26, and the court said he had no connection to Al-Qaeda. He'd been wrongly detained. There's still 180 detainees at Guantanamo. According to the BBC, in a ruling delivered on May 26, U.S. District Judge Henry Kennedy said U.S. government lawyers had failed to persuade him that Mr. Odaini, Mohammed Odaini, had been lawfully detained. The judge said, quote, "The evidence before the court shows that holding Odaini in custody at such great cost to him has done nothing to make the United States more secure. There is no evidence that Odaini has any connection to Al-Qaeda." He went on to say, respondents, that would be the U.S. government, had kept a young man from Yemen in detention from age 18 to age 26. They had prevented him from seeing his family, denied him the opportunity to complete his studies and embark on a career. Oh, yeah, they hate us because we own houses.
On an airline, had his name on a secret list. He was taking away with his laptop, and as he left, he called out to me. I'm in the air, Guantanamo. I heard the girls are sweeter there.
Right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
It's 25 before the hour. I get a lot of interesting emails about the why. Okay. The police in New Orleans have been charged in the post-Katrina shootings and cover-up. Six current or former police officers. Charged in connection with the shootings on the Danziger Bridge that left two dead and four wounded. Four of the cops charged today. Sergeant Kenneth Brown, Sergeant Robert Jacevius, Officer Anthony Villavaso, and former Officer Robert Falcone were accused in the killing of a 17-year-old named James Brissett. Mr. Falcone was also charged with shooting a 40-year-old mentally disabled man in the back. Ronald Madison was his name, and Sergeant Bowen was... I meant Sergeant Kenneth Bowen. Sergeant Bowen was charged with kicking and stomping Mr. Madison while he was dying on the ground, a 40-year-old mentally disabled man. All of the officers could possibly face the death penalty. Nah. Charges were announced at a news conference attended by Eric Holder, the Attorney General, Tom Perez, the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division, Jim Letton, the United States Attorney in New Orleans, and several federal prosecutors and FBI officials. Five other police officers have already been charged in connection with the killings, etc., etc. The writer, and his name escapes me, from The Nation, who a couple of years ago first broke the story with eyewitness reports and names and so on and so forth. And, of course, mainstream media wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. Oh, no. Unbelievable stuff. The Danziger Bridge. Now, one of the comments made was that, well, these black people were on their way into a white enclave to steal things like groceries. And therefore the police had to. Now, the police always said that they were acting in self-defense, that their lives were in imminent danger, and therefore they had to murder and kick and stomp. Had to do it, man. I mean, damn. You know, these Negroes were trying to get into the white people's neighborhood. Oh, no. This may be New Orleans, but, you know, the lines are the lines. The Venus Project. You remember last night I said go to thevenusproject.com and let me know what you think? Well, I got two responses today. First one is from Susan in Squim, Washington. Mike, greetings from sunny Squim. You mentioned the Venus Project on last night's show and asked us to go to the website and tell you what we think. I had never heard of it before and was quite taken with it, actually. The Venus Project is like a realization of the kind of society for Earth that Gene Roddenberry fleshed out in his Star Trek series. I've always felt that this futuristic society is what made the show so popular, far more popular than any other science fiction series has ever become. It was a technogian socialist society where everyone was allowed and encouraged to reach their full potential. There was no need for money because capitalism had failed centuries before and was laid to rest. It was the ultimate in freedom without any of the societal pressures we face today, and it was a totally classless society. That was Star Trek. Very often, the brave adventurers from the Federation of Planets would meet up with other cultures that were still using the old system that we today use, and they were always found to be unhappy or superficial. We are taught from birth in our society that to reach one's potential means one must try to become as rich as one can. He who has the most toys wins. Everyone in the middle class has a constant worry about making ends meet. We worry about the house payments, the medical bills, keeping a job, putting the kids through college, and always we are told that America is this dream place where, quote, anyone can make it, but making it means finally having enough money to not have those worries. The pressure is always there. And the American dream, as one gets older, seems always out of reach for many. More like winning the lottery would be than anything real or attainable. And so in the end, in our so-called free society, unless you are in that top 1%, which is the ruling class, there's no real peace for most people. It's always just survival. And for many, that survival can be joyless. So the Star Trek world was a peek into the future without the staying alive worries, without poverty, and with filled with satisfaction and attainable goals. No wonder it was so popular. This Venus Project sounds very much like that. I do wish them luck with it. I haven't read all of it on the site yet, so I have no idea how they expect to gradually move to it and talk everyone else into it, too. I think they will have a hard slog of it. When the teabagging element we now have afoot gets wind of this, they will undoubtedly call it some kind of commie, pinko, hippie commune spawned by the Antichrist. Susan. Well, that's one opinion. Now here's one from Mike, who writes from Southport near the shores of the Gulf Dead Sea. He writes, "Hey, Mike, you did a short request last night to check out the Venus Project. Jacques Frescos and Roseanne Meadows International Organization out of Venus, Florida, and closely associated with devotee Peter Joseph's Zeitgeist movement. I didn't need to check it out. I invested a year trying to grok the plans, the feasibility, the organization, the people, and their motivations. I listened to the weekly and biweekly streams and podcasts, downloaded and burned to DVD all the Zeitgeist movies, participated in teleconferences, did everything except get the T-shirt. There are thousands of followers and hundreds of local organizations around the globe. I couldn't do it. I've walked away. Here's my short synopsis. A beautiful utopian concept with many elaborate levels. It is a generational plan that would not become minimally functional for at least 100 years, and therein lies a major flaw. Try to hold any organization together in its original intent for a dozen years. Jacques is a great designer. A sci-fi paperback industry is missing a cover artist. And along with Roseanne, has been promoting his dreams of land development for years from semi-Florida retirement. Peter Joseph, is the roadman lecturer and has carved out a world traveling comfortable career and lifestyle by selling Jacques' concepts full time. I wouldn't go so far as to call any of them as phonies. I'm convinced that they all are true believers, like so many evangelists, but the organization is underfunded. The concept reaches out beyond the founders' graves. The universal nature of man is underestimated, and all is too loosely managed, far worse than any mega church or county government. Like the Domino Pizza Man's Utopian City, Guy Lombardo's Terra Verde, and the Disney urban developments, these ideas grow unabated in South Florida, unfettered by diminishing water supplies or global warming-inspired rising seas. Hope this helps. Sincerely, Mike. So there you have it, two entirely different takes on the Venus Project. I didn't know there was a connection, because I haven't gotten that far into it, between the Venus Project and the Zeitgeist movement. Because I liked the Zeitgeist movies, films, documentaries, whatever you want to call them. I thought they were very interesting. I guess like is not the right word. Robert Kennedy Jr. has filed for divorce. Matter of fact, he filed for divorce just days before his wife was charged with drunk driving, according to court papers. In Westchester County, New York, Kennedy, a lawyer, author, and environmental activist, not to mention one of the co-hosts of Ring of Fire, filed the papers May 12th. A day later, police responded to reports of a, quote, domestic incident, end quote, at the couple's Bedford, New York home, in which Kennedy said his wife, Mary, had been drinking. According to court documents, Mary Kennedy called police herself, was, quote, visibly intoxicated, end quote, and told police her husband was, quote, verbally abusive to her and her children, end quote. Later that week, Mary Kennedy was arrested on suspicion of drinking and driving after she jumped a curb at a school in Bedford. She had a blood alcohol level of 0.11. The legal limit is 0.08. Who was it that was mentioning last night about the curse of alcoholism in politically prominent families? What else we have here? Oh, yeah. You know, a lot of the morons who listen to this program and try to figure out how a communist bastard like me possibly could be on the air probably miss stories like this one in the Times. It's all over the place about the diabetes drug maker that hid the test data. The makers of Avandia, SmithKline, Beecham, SKB, or GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, take your pick. In the fall of 1999, the drug giant SmithKline Beecham secretly began a study to find out if its diabetes medicine, Avandia, was safer for the heart than a competing pill, Actos, made by Takeda. In a moment, the results of that study.
Watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
My producer is very cynical tonight.
It's an institute you can't disparage.
In the fall of 1999, the drug giant SmithKline Beecham, as they were known back then, secretly began a study to find out if its diabetes medicine, Avandia, was safer for the heart than a competing pill, Actos, made by a company named Takeda. Avandia's success was crucial to SmithKline, whose labs were otherwise all but barren of new products. But the study's results, completed that same year, were disastrous. Not only was Avandia no better than Actos, but the study also provided clear signs that Avandia was riskier to the heart. In other words, it might kill you. But instead of publishing the results, the company spent the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years trying to cover up the results. The company did not post the results on its website or submit them to federal drug regulators, as is required by law. The heart risks from Avandia first became public 8 years later, in 2007, with a study from a cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic who used data the company was forced by a lawsuit to post on its own website. In the ensuing months, GlaxoSmithKline, its new name, officials from that company conceded that they had known about the drug's potential heart attack risk since at least 2005. But you see, corporate executives, you are liars. You knew about it in 1999. The latest documents demonstrate that the company had data about Avandia's extensive heart problems almost as soon as the drug was introduced in 1999 and sought intensively to keep those risks from becoming public. The company said that Avandia is safe and that Dr. Freed, Martin I. Freed, a SmithKline executive, wrote in an email message dated March 29, 2001 about the study results, quote, "This was done for the U.S. business, way under the radar. Per senior management request, these data should not see the light of day to anyone outside GlaxoSmithKline." The company said that Avandia was safe and that Dr. Freed, who wrote that nasty little email, no longer works for GlaxoSmithKline. So once again, how many drugs is this? I mean, just about every single one of these drugs, the prescription level painkillers. Remember those that were killing people like flies on a summer afternoon? Remember those? And the diabetes drugs and the fen-phen. Remember fen-phen? Oh, it's going to help you get rid of the fat. Ah, except in the process, it will also kill you. But when you're dead, you get very thin. You really do. And where was the FDA during all this? Where was the FDA? Where it usually is, I guess, attending soirees put together by the drug industry, going to junkets and excursions and parties and hanging out and drinking and getting laid and doing drugs and putting money in the hip pocket and looking the other way, right? Right? That's one. Here's two. Just before sunset on April 10th, 2006, a DC-9 jet landed at the international airport in the port city of Ciudad del Carmen, 500 miles east of Mexico City. As soldiers on the ground approached the plane, the crew tried to shoo them away, saying there was a dangerous oil leak. So the troops grew suspicious and searched the jet. They found 128 black suitcases packed with 5.7 tons of cocaine valued at $100 million. The stash was supposed to have been delivered from Caracas to drug traffickers in Toluca near Mexico City. The smugglers had bought the DC-9 with laundered funds they transferred through two of the biggest banks in the United States, Wachovia and Bank of America. This was no isolated incident. Wachovia, it turns out, had made a habit of helping move money for Mexican drug smugglers. San Francisco's Wells Fargo and Company, which bought Wachovia in 2008, has admitted in court that its unit failed to monitor and report suspected money laundering by narcotics traffickers, including the cash used to buy four planes that shipped a total of 22 tons of cocaine. The admission came in an agreement that Wachovia struck with federal prosecutors in March, and it sheds light on the largely undocumented role of U.S. banks in contributing to the violent drug trade that has convulsed Mexico for the past 4 years. Wachovia admitted it didn't do enough to spot illicit funds in handling $378 billion for Mexican currency exchange houses from 2004 to 2007. That's the largest violation of the Bank Secrecy Act in U.S. history. $378 billion through one U.S. bank. Oh, drug money? There's drug money in our bank? No, we thought it was money from Mexican citrus farmers. 7 past the hour. Welcome back. So, GlaxoSmithKline and Avandia and Wachovia and Bank of America Corporation and billions of dollars in drug money. I mean, it just never stops. This is your capitalist system at work, folks. This is the capitalist system that is poisonous to human life. It's poisonous to life on the planet. It is death and destruction. And you poor brain-dead right-wingers out there who have the gall to call me up and challenge me on that statement, don't ever. Federal prosecutor who handled the drug bank case said Wachovia's blatant disregard for our banking laws gave international cocaine cartels a virtual carte blanche to finance their operations. Since 2006, more than 22,000 people have been killed in drug-related battles that have raged mostly along the 2,000-mile border that Mexico shares with the United States.
Oh, but we got to go down there and stop those Mexicans from coming over here and taking our jobs.
The hypocrisy in this country is so deep and so thick that anyone who believed in some kind of a master planner of the universe would look at what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico as a kick in the ass to the United States, a way of the cosmic thespian saying, hey, pay attention. 300 billion dollars. Among the dead are police, soldiers, journalists, ordinary citizens. In Ciudad Juarez, just across the border from El Paso, 700 people have been killed this year, as of mid-June. Why, that's more than we've lost in Afghanistan and Iraq combined. Mexican President Felipe Calderón vowed to crush the drug cartels when he took office in December 2006, and he's since deployed 45,000 troops to fight the cartels. They've had little success. Well, how can you succeed when Bank of America Corporation and Wachovia and God knows how many other U.S. banks continue to finance the operation? How are you going to succeed?
Well, I know. Let's go in the south side of Chicago. No, let's go to the Bronx in New York. No, let's go over here in the neighborhoods in Atlanta and bust these crappy ass reefer dealers. That's what we'll do. Yeah, let's bust them.
The United States has pledged Mexico $1.1 billion in the past 2 years to aid in the fight against narcotics cartels. $1.1 billion. Woo-hoo! And meanwhile, Wachovia was funneling drug money to the tune of hundreds of billions. Do you understand that? 300, unless the New York Times, or I'm sorry, Bloomberg News has made a terrible mistake here. It says Wachovia admitted it didn't do enough to spot illicit funds in handling $378.4 billion for Mexican currency exchange houses from 2004 to 2007. Oh, I'm sorry. We didn't do enough. What's the fine? 50 grand? Is it $1 million? Okay, here, I've got it right here in my hip pocket. Oh, 2 million? Okay, well, I got it in my hip pocket and my coat pocket. I'm sorry. Sorry. Martin Woods, director of Wachovia's anti-money laundering unit in London from 2006 to 2009, said, quote, it's the banks laundering money for the cartels that finances this tragedy, end quote. Woods says he quit the bank in disgust after executives ignored his documentation that drug dealers were funneling money through Wachovia's branch network. He said, quote, if you don't see the connection between the money laundering by banks and the 22,000 people killed in Mexico, you're missing the point, end quote.
Oh, but let's build a fence down there on the Mexican border because, you know, these people keep coming over here and they want to clean our toilets and clean out our swimming pools and pick our lettuce. We can't have that. There's lots of Americans who want those jobs. And the sad fact is that's true now, huh? Now that we live in the post-Bush economy.
Wachovia is just one of the U.S. and European banks that have been used for laundering. For two decades, Latin American drug traffickers have gone to U.S. banks to cleanse their dirty cash. American Express Bank International paid fines in 1994 and 2007. Well, my goodness, that's quite a spread there, isn't it? That's 13 years. After admitting it had failed to spot and report drug dealers, failed to spot? Oh, for God's sake. And report drug dealers laundering money through its accounts. Drug traffickers used accounts at Bank of America in Oklahoma City to buy three planes, carried 10 tons of cocaine. On and on and on it goes. Mexican drug dealers use shell companies to open accounts at HSBC Holdings PLC, Europe's biggest bank, by assets. A Mexican judge on January 22nd accused the owners of six Centros Cambiarios, or money changers, in Culiacan and Tijuana of laundering drug funds through their accounts at the Mexican units of Banco Santander S.A., Citigroup, Inc., and HSBC, according to court documents. Citigroup, Wachovia, Bank of America Corporation. What, 22,000 people dead in the drug war? Oh, damn, well, you know, it's collateral damage. We're sorry about that. What's the fine? Is it a million? Here, I got it in my pocket. Wait a minute. It's 2 million? Here, it's in the top desk drawer. 3 million? Oh, please, here. 10 million? All right. Wait a minute. Let me get to my trench coat. There. Now, will you leave my ass alone? We've got business to do! Unbelievable stuff. Unbelievable. $348 billion.
Well, Mike, that wasn't all drug money. That's just money being processed through Wachovia for money exchanges in Mexico. Doesn't mean anything. Oh, really? Oh, yeah. There's other businesses in Mexico besides drugs. Come on, man. You know, we have a factory in Tijuana that makes those little things you put on your car, the little bouncy head thing. I mean, come on, man. We do all kinds of things. And quit talking like that. It sounds like you're mocking us. No, I'm not mocking you. Not at all.
From Greg Patton in Florida, journalist. Regarding the new BP cap, he writes, Mike, firstly, BP wouldn't be taking the time and effort with this new cap a few weeks before the relief well is estimated to be complete if they did not know that the relief well has a very little chance of being successful. Imagine trying to pick up a pea with a mile-long straw. The chances of intersecting the well miles below the seabed are about the same. That would explain why BP is drilling two relief wells. Even if the relief well manages to intersect the main well, the sandblasting effect may have eroded the main well enough that it cannot be plugged with drilling mud and cement. If the pressure from the well blew out the mud from the top kill, why would anyone think the same thing could not happen deeper down, where the pressure is just as great, if not more? Secondly, there have been numerous reports of additional leaks in the well bore itself and from fissures on the ocean floor near the site. Installing this new cap will confirm that, and if that is the case, neither the cap nor the relief wells will stop the leak. Lastly, if this cap actually does work, it would provide a means to accurately measure how much oil has been flowing into the Gulf, which most scientists know is far more than BP or the feds have admitted. That is crucial in determining how many billions of dollars BP will pay in fines. Do you think BP really wants that information to get out? And you better clean your water up. 21 past the hour. Why not? Okay, Andre writes, aren't drug cartels considered to be terrorists? Yes. Where are the anti-terrorism laws that we've enacted in this country? The Patriot Act, aiding and abetting terrorists, or the drug cartels' freedom fighters, like, you know, the Taliban? Bank of America, Wachovia. Wait, we bailed them out, didn't we? I don't know, Andre. So that's our money? Huh? Maybe that's why the banks failed. They took their customers' money and gave $300 billion to terrorist groups. Holy cow! Yeah, why? That's from Andre. Yeah, why not charge these banks with terrorism? I mean, 22,000 dead people as a result of the drug wars? What is that, six times, five times the number of Americans killed in Bush's and Obama's two wars? Yeah, why not charge Wachovia with acts of terror? No. No, that's not the way it works, Mike. In a capitalist society, the person that gets charged with an act of terror is the person that stands up during a Senate hearing with a banner that says, go green.
Whoa, God! Get that commie out of here! Oh! Arrest her! Quick!
So I went to the Reuters Wire and the AP Wire. Reuters Wire says, BP delayed a critical test to determine how to proceed with a cap on its blown-out oil well intended to block the flow of oil that has been gushing in the Gulf of Mexico for the last 12 weeks. U.S. authorities announced on Tuesday night the energy giant is postponing the test to establish whether the well can withstand the pressure caused by closing the cap on top of the ruptured wellhead. The test, due to last between 6 and 48 hours, was originally scheduled for late Tuesday on BP's newly installed capping stack, which has a better seal than the last cap placed on the well and aims to stop oil from spewing. It should be able to contain the blow oil. The only way to permanently kill the leak was a ruptured one. Okay. Boom. I keep seeing these Scientology ads on television. There's one running right now on MSNBC, the sound of which I have turned down. God, they look so inviting. You know, join a cult. I mean, if you're going to join a cult, why not sign up for Scientology and let them suck your brains out? All these teabaggers, you know what your teabaggers ought to do? I mean, come on, get real. You need to get clear. You need to read L. Ron Hubbard's book. You really do. You need to experience the joys of having your brain cells sucked out, realigned, and pumped back in. Why don't some of you teabaggers become Scientologists? You know, you can get in there with what's their names? The two big, John Travolta and Tom Cruise. Huh? Come on. These commercials, though, for Scientology. Oh, my God. You know, I look at those. They're done in kind of a blue haze. You know, kind of like, I guess it's supposed to remind you subliminally, if you're of a certain age, of Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze. But this is Blue Haze. You know, it's a very subliminal kind of approach. This blue haze. And here are these people. You know, there's a civil rights worker and somebody with their arms splayed out like they're being crucified. And the voiceover is so cool, so blue, so diffused, so Scientology, man. Get clear. I always thought L. Ron Hubbard was just, I mean, absolute genius. It's too bad that he's, you know, died before he could really collect. I guess he got royalties from the science fiction books, but the Scientology thing, man, what a scam. It's almost as bad as Christianity. Scientology, the science of science.
I thought that was so cool. Scientology, the science of science. Brrr.
Man.
Well, here, another $10,000 and you'll get even clearer.
What?
Oh, yeah. You know, religion isn't free.
I thought freedom wasn't free.
Well, that isn't either.
We'll be back.
Down to the very last breath. Why am I so out of breath? The captain said, excuse me, ma'am, the species has amused itself to death.
Arm yourself with the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. There is a financial regulation bill making its way through the legislative process. And Republicans, of course, are very determined to block the bill, which can't even be debated on the floor of the Senate unless 60 senators support a cloture vote, right? So what's the problem here? Republican senators are pretty much united in opposition to this regulatory reform legislation, which has passed the House, but still needs an okay from the Senate. Well, Massachusetts Senator and teabag Benedict Arnold Scott Brown has assured that there will be at least one Republican vote in the Senate for the report on the financial regulatory reform bill, his. And because of Scott Brown's decision, as John Nichols, writing at The Nation, points out, it will be harder for Republican legislators to claim that the proposal offers more evidence of the forward march of socialism in America. Oh, my God! Republicans say that it's not that they oppose regulating Wall Street and the big banks. No, of course not. No, we don't oppose that. No, no, really, we really don't. No, we don't. We don't. Do we? No, of course we don't. Rather, the argument goes like this. They're afraid of big government, of the socialist sort, that might actually try to accomplish something useful, as opposed to big government of the Dick Cheney, bloated defense budgets and needless wars sort. Socialism! Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell says his caucus is trying, quote, to prevent the Democrats from doing to the financial services industry what they just did to the health care of this country, end quote. So once again, according to the conservatives, these little crickets, a modest measure must be blocked because it would put the country on the slippery slope to socialism. South Carolina Republican Jim DeMint, the Senate watchdog against all things socialist, is denouncing the bill as a, quote, massive, ill-advised piece of legislation that would make it harder for kids to get braces. Seriously, I mean, that's what he's saying. The Financial Regulation Limited Bill. Oh, my God. Michelle Bachmann, the crazy woman from Minnesota, summed things up when she outlined her case, all right, maybe the better word is rant, for opposing basic consumer protections in a few minor moves to avoid future meltdowns. She said, quote, this is the Financial Reform Bill. She said, quote, this is breathtaking in the level of power that government will have over our lives when it comes to credit. It gives government the authority to decide, for instance, how much a bank teller in Peoria, Illinois will be making going forward because a pay czar will decide what anyone in banking will be able to make, end quote. And as Nichols points out, never mind that socialists actually fought against czars, but that's history and we're talking teabaggers here. The whole thing still sounds Soviet-y, doesn't it? Doesn't sound a little Soviet-y? And never mind that DeMint and Bachmann are wrong. Kids will still be able to get braces. Banks in Peoria will still pay tellers less than they should, and the reform legislation makes no mention of czars. Indeed, to the extent that there is attention to what banks and brokers pay employees, the focus is on the CEOs that earn $1,000 an hour, not on tellers who are hoping to get to $10 an hour. But Mitch McConnell and Jim DeMint and the crazy woman from Minnesota don't have to worry, because legislation does not break up banks too big to fail, quote unquote, or restore the safeguards established after the Great Depression, the Glass-Steagall Act. Doesn't do any of that. That separated Main Street banks from the big Wall Street firms. And as a matter of fact, the legislation doesn't even meet the standard of effective regulation. It's certainly not socialism. Who says so? Well, the socialists. Nicholas Nix, N-I-X, who is running for a U.S. House seat in Texas, apparently he's a socialist, offers an outline of real reform. Here's what he said, quote, I believe in strong regulation on any business that can completely destroy this country economically. I also believe in the repeal of the 1999 Graham-Leach-Bliley Act that helped banks merge with insurance companies and security companies. Never again should the U.S. have a proverbial gun pointed to its head and demanded to pay or die economically by big business. Never again should we shell out another dollar to a business that does not know how to hold on to their own dollars, end quote. Woo! That's socialism! Dan Labatz, who's running for the Senate in Ohio as a proud Buckeye socialist, argues that, quote, none of the problems facing this country can be dealt with unless we end the domination of banks, insurance companies, and multinational corporations over both major parties and over our political system, end quote.
Whoa.
Labatz's platform says not a penny more for the banks and the bankers. Take over the banks. Why? That's socialism. His website, Labatz, the Ohio Socialist, the Buckeye Socialist, sounds very much like Malloy socialism, doesn't it? He says the U.S. government should nationalize the banks, creating something like a U.S. credit union, which with offices throughout the country, providing loans to small businesses, homeowners, and cooperatives. Low interest loans should be advanced to working people for home improvements, for the purchase of large appliances, and for vacations. Educational loans would not be necessary because we would tax corporations to pay for free education. The U.S. credit union, should it come into existence, should deny credit to speculators and gamblers in the markets. Wow. Now that's socialism. What Barack Obama is doing is corporatism. But the crazy woman from Minnesota and the crazier woman from Alaska and Mitch McConnell and the rest of these psychopathic bastards understand something. And that is that A, we Americans are ignorant. B, we Americans are unemployed. And C, which follows A and B, we are scared. And it's very easy to up the scare meter.
Barack Obama is a socialist from Kenya. Ugh! And he's a Negro. How did that happen? Oh, my God, we have to take our country back.
From what?
From the Negro.
Oh, I thought you meant from the corporatist, capitalist people that are destroying the United States. Barack Obama is just following in the footsteps of his four or five immediate predecessors. He's not doing anything bad in terms of corporatism or capitalism. Matter of fact, he's doing good things for corporatism and capitalism.
No, he's a socialist.
Oh, really? He's a socialist. Now, there is one Democrat who has refused to go along with the whole can of worms, and that would be Russ Feingold. He made a decision, and this was at Politico.com. He made a decision to become the only Democrat to vote against Wall Street reform. And he's kind of pissing off the liberals. The progressives figured the Wisconsin Democrat would be first in line to sign up for this financial regulatory overhaul. Instead, he's been opposed to the legislation. Feingold calls it a cave into Wall Street. And in doing so, Russ Feingold almost single-handedly is delaying the final vote and denying, at least temporarily, President Barack Obama's second legislative triumph. The handoff to the insurance companies, the health insurance companies, was the first triumph. Now the handoff to the banking industry is the second triumph. You go, Barack! But Russ Feingold has said, no, this is, I'm paraphrasing, I don't know what he said, but what he's saying is this is nonsense. It's nonsense. So Feingold says, no, I'm not going to vote for it. Meanwhile, Senator Scott Brown, the teabagger, says, well, I'll vote for it. It's madness. Before the hour, I haven't mentioned recently here, but thanks to the people who contribute to this program, Sharon Gordy is our military affairs correspondent, Bruce Enberg, economic affairs, Kate Petrini, education affairs, Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf, ethics advisors. And the program's engineer and producer is Kathy Bay. Ah. One column that you really should take a moment to read was in today's New York Times. You can get it at the website, nyt.com, by Bob Herbert, entitled Outside the Casino. It is pertinent to what we were just talking about the regulation of Wall Street bill that is working its way through the Senate. Regulation of Wall Street. Right. Yeah, that's happening. It isn't, but we're supposed to believe it is. And when this bill passes, if it passes, what did they say at Politico.com? It will be the second legislative triumph for President Obama. Captain Mary writes from Memphis. To wit, teabaggers are generally anti-abortion, right? Yet they support deregulation of corporations like Monsanto. I wonder if they know that Monsanto is in the abortion business. Oh, not overtly, of course. It's just that, as shown by independent scientific tests, Monsanto's GMO so-called foods cause neonatal death and in utero fetal death. Unnatural, natural abortion, we might say. Plus those other things that they don't mention, like low sperm count, infertility in the following generations, and other reproductive dysfunctions. Couple that with the bankruptcy-related suicides in India, which is a direct result of Monsanto's lies about its special brand of cotton. The various scientific proofs of damage by GMO foods to virtually every organ in the body, permanent alteration of DNA, and so on. Shouldn't Monsanto's executives be prosecuted for murder? Terrorism? Crimes against humanity? I think so, Cat Mary says. But who am I? Yeah, there's so many acts of terror being committed by corporate America. I mean, the list is just endless, isn't it? From the weapons manufacturers to the mega banks to the gene-altering processed food companies. I mean, who else? The energy industry. Shouldn't it be considered an act of terror to interfere on the level that BP has interfered with the livelihoods of all these tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people on the U.S. Gulf Coast? Isn't that an act of terrorism? Let's supposing there is a cannery somewhere in Louisiana, south of New Orleans, a cannery where they can, some kind of little fish. Now, this is pre-BP oil eruption, of course. And in this cannery, a lot of Vietnamese and Latinos and Croatians who work in this factory, and they're making $6.50 an hour, and they have to work 10-hour shifts. And let's supposing that somebody from the cannery union decides to come down and organize the workers. And the quickest way to organize the workers is to call a general strike. So he does, or she does, depending on who the organizer is, or the incipient organizer, and all the workers walk out. Do you know, under the legislation passed during the Bush crime family's reign over this country, that the organizer and the workers can now be charged with an act of terrorism? Indeed, under the USA Patriot Act, updated. Did you know that? You didn't? You should. But the bankers and the oil cartel chiefs and the weapons manufacturers and the people that blow the tops off of mountains in West Virginia, terrorism? Oh, please, Malloy. Your socialism is showing. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.
Complete.